Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to the Big Life Podcast on Full Service Radio. We are Lina Salazar
and Ingrid Vaishus,
broadcasting live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C. The Big Life brings inspiring people to talk about their stress story and what they learned from making changes. We also sit with experts, therapists, scientists, and holistic professionals who shed light on the effects of stress on your well-being and give you the tools to help you live a bigger, more fulfilling life. I am Lina Salazar, a health coach and the creator of the Food Sanity Program. I work with women whose main source of stress is their relationship with food.
And I'm Ingrid Vaishus, also a health coach. I help my clients discover achievable, sustainable strategies to better health so they can avoid burnout and thrive at home and at work. I work with individuals and organizations.
Ingrid, I love podcasts that help me see things with a different lens. Podcasts that broaden my understanding of reality, lead to powerful realizations, and motivate behavior change. And I am sure that this will be that kind of podcast for our episodes, for our listeners, regardless of their gender. We are going to talk about diet culture. And as I tell the women I coach, whether we are aware of it or not, diet culture is that force that influences people's beliefs about health, fat, weight, beauty, food, and yes, self-worth. Diet culture explains why the diet industry is worth billions of dollars, and it's also at the root of eating disorders, food obsessions, weight stigma, depression, anxiety, and discrimination. And today, our listeners will learn what is diet culture, how it might be affecting their well-being, and ways in which we can free ourselves from the expectations imposed by diet culture. And no one better to talk about diet culture than our guest, Christy Harrison. Christy is an anti-diet registered dietitian, nutritionist, and certified intuitive eating counselor based in New York City. Since 2013, Christy has hosted FoodSight, a great podcast exploring people's relationship with food and paths to body liberation. It is now one of iTunes' top 100 health podcasts, reaching tens of thousands of listeners worldwide each week. Christy, I am very excited to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So we love to start the conversation with our guests of how they got into what they were doing. What was your aha moment that made you realize this was your life's purpose and what you wanted to focus on?
Yeah, it was definitely a winding path. I wouldn't say it was one aha moment, kind of a series of little aha moments along the way, I guess. But my story is really that I started out as a journalist. I actually never had any real issues with food growing up until about age 20 when I studied abroad in Paris and went on a different birth control pill, gained a little bit of weight, came back and decided to lose weight. And that's where it all began, my disordered eating. And I was struggling with my own disordered eating when I went into my first career as a journalist. And because I was restricting food, dieting, depriving myself, I was obsessed with food. And that was something I wanted to think about all day, every day, and research. And, you know, so interested in nutrition and health from that perspective. So I chose food and nutrition as sort of my beat in journalism. And that was where it all began. That's where my career really started. I got interested in the food politics movement, like Michael Pollan, Marion Nestle, this idea of food systems, sustainability. And I took that information basically as a weapon to use against myself. I ended up, you know, getting further and further into this orthorexic mindset. Mm-hmm. Orthorexia is a term that was coined a little bit later, but it's known as unhealthy obsession with healthy eating, right? Mm-hmm. Really, I would argue any obsession with anything is quote unquote unhealthy. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, obsession with healthy eating. And so when I was doing that work as a journalist, I got deeper and deeper into my own disordered eating in a lot of ways. I started to come out of it when I started working at a food magazine, Gourmet, which is now defunct, but at the time it had been going for 75 years, really popular, well-respected food magazine. And the people that I was working with there, generally speaking, had pretty good relationships with food. There were some exceptions. There were some folks that I learned after the fact were also struggling with their own disordered eating. But a lot of the people I was spending time with at work and outside of work were people with really good relationships with food. And the work itself really forced me to drop some of my restrictions and stop being as fearful of particular foods. So I was, you know, had been gluten-free on and off for a while when I was a freelance writer and in my first full-time job as a journalist, and dropped that when I started working at Gourmet. I dropped a few of the other restrictions and, you know, generally eased up and sort of allowed myself to eat everything, but still had a lot of the self-punishing language in my head and self-punishing behaviors outside of work, which was increasingly less and less time mm-hmm. that I actually had to spend outside of work because I had a very busy job and worked really long hours. And Gourmet ended up folding. They closed the magazine in 2009. I sort of heard rumblings that something was coming. I didn't know what. And so I looked into going back to school to become a dietitian and to get my master's in public health nutrition because I wanted something that was a little bit more stable than journalism. I wanted to, you know, maybe get out of the industry or diversify a little bit from an industry that was so volatile at the time. So, but another inspiration for going back to school certainly was maybe I'll finally get my own issues under control, aka maybe I'll finally be able to eat perfectly, quote unquote, and lose weight, you know? And so that was definitely kind of a secondary motivation there going back to school too. Fortunately, when I was in school, I ended up discovering the book Intuitive Eating. Not through any of my classes or schoolwork, but through an independent research project I was doing. I decided I wanted to write a book in my copious spare time in graduate school and started researching a book about the history of emotional eating. And so through that research, I discovered intuitive eating. I discovered other researchers who were doing research on the concept of so-called emotional eating, really showing that diets are the root of it and that restriction is actually what drives, you know, so-called emotional eating, not really emotions themselves. And so I was amassing all this research and it just was a little too cognitively dissonant for me at the time, I think, to fully get it. That was, you know, back in 2009, 2010. So I was like just starting to dip my toe into this world of intuitive eating. A friend introduced me to the concept of health at every size. And that was also something I was just, it was very cognitively dissonant at the time. I was resistant to it and didn't dive in right away. But then I ended up specializing in eating disorders. I ended up, well, winding path exactly, not exactly, you know, linear with that is that I didn't end up going anywhere with that book proposal, but that sort of was the jumping off point for my next personal journalistic project, which was starting my podcast, Food Psych. I started that in 2013, in early 2013, and at the same time was deciding, you know, what to specialize in as a dietitian. I was in my last phases of the rotations that we have to do to get licensure and, you know, working as a nutritionist already. I had been working for 3 years at the City Department of Health and was just starting my own private practice and decided that, you know, with all of this interest I had in people's relationships with food, I wanted to specialize in eating disorders. So I started getting training on that. I started going to conferences and, you know, trainings and webinars and just looking into the research and the literature as much as I could find. And what I was finding again and again was that intuitive eating was considered sort of the gold standard of recovery, that that's like where people with disordered eating recover to, you know, in a perfect world, and that health at every size, the philosophy of health at every size, which really is about taking care of your health without weight loss being the goal, taking weight loss off the table, was and is considered an essential framework for eating disorder recovery. I'm seeing health at every size mentioned again and again at conferences I was going to and trainings and stuff like that. So that was sort of the moment, I guess, in which I realized, you know, not only was I wanting to specialize in eating disorders, but that I wanted to bring in this health at every size and intuitive eating philosophy to my work and to my podcast. And so I started doing that in the second season of the podcast, and it really sort of shifted my career trajectory from there.
Yeah,
so I wouldn't say that I, you know, necessarily at any point was like, this is what I'm going to do with my life, but it sort of found me through that winding path. You know?
A wise path. Thank you for sharing your story. And let's unpack a little bit, because you've said so many valuable things. It seems to me that your journey sort of like showed you that there are other alternatives, right, of viewing health and of understanding your relationship with food. And you also got a good sense of how diet culture influenced sort of like your own relationship with food and your body, etc. So why don't you tell our listeners, what is diet culture? Let's define it for them. And most importantly, highlight that this is not a conversation only for people with eating disorders or disorder eating.
Right. And disordered eating is really a spectrum, I want to say.
Yeah.
So I think most people in our culture have some form of disordered eating. And I think sectioning off eating disorders as their own separate thing is in some ways really problematic, because everybody has some, you know, disordered eating in Western culture anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, what I define as diet culture is this system of beliefs that's really endemic to Western culture that worships thinness and equates it to health and moral virtue, promotes weight loss as a means of attaining higher status, health status or moral status, and really both in diet culture, demonizes certain foods and ways of eating while elevating others. So this good and bad food rhetoric that we hear so often. And then oppresses people who don't match up with that supposed picture of health. So really it is a system of oppression, and it's born out of other systems of oppression as well, like patriarchy, racism, xenophobia. Those are all at the root of diet culture, and I really delve into that in my book in the history chapter. But there's just so much in diet culture that is oppressive and that is based out of pre-existing systems mm-hmm. of oppression. And now diet culture has become sort of its own system of oppression that overlaps and interlocks with those other forms of oppression.
Cool. So, I mean, there are some very obvious signs of diet culture. I think we see it a lot at the grocery stores. We see it a lot in magazines. What are some more subtle ways that we might miss that are so ingrained in us that we might not be seeing as diet culture?
Yeah, great question. So I think, you know, this idea of demonizing certain foods and ways of eating while elevating others, there's a lot of subtle ways where that shows up, right? Like thinking, oh, I can't have that food, or I can only eat that on the weekend, or I'm cutting sugar out of my life, or I'm cutting out gluten, I'm cutting out dairy, you know, not with a medical necessity, but with this general idea of it's healthier or I'll feel better, not, you know, based on true medical diagnosis. There's also, you know, serving yourself less food than you really want because you think that you should, quote unquote, be eating less, right? So these portion size rules that people might have in their head from diets they followed in the past or from just diet culture in general, saying like, watch what you eat, right? Generally kind of quote unquote, watching what you eat is one of those really subtle ways that diet culture can manifest. So, you know, whether it's rules about particular foods, times of day when you're allowed to eat, that's something that's coming up a lot these days with intermittent fasting, you know, or types of foods like with keto or Whole30, there's a lot of demonization of particular foods and food groups. But also anything where weight is the focus or where weight is treated as a barometer of worthiness or health. So, you know, if you think, oh, I really got to watch it because my body's getting bigger and that's bad, that's unhealthy, or that's wrong, diet culture too, or I really need to lose weight. It's just not okay for me to be at this weight. And I know that that is problematic, and there's sort of like layers of weight stigma and body shame that are different based on the size of body you actually live in. So as someone who has always lived in a thinner body, I've never experienced actually moving through the world in a larger body where doctors tell you to lose weight every time you go in, where, you know, people shame you in the schoolyard or walking around or at work or what have you, where family members tell you you need to lose weight or that there's a problem with your body size. You know, all of those things are things that happen disproportionately and in some cases exclusively to people in larger bodies, like the issue of being told to lose weight at the doctor's office or an issue of, you know, not fitting into an airplane seat or a theater seat or things like that, issues where the world is not made for your body, the world is not accessible to your body. Those are issues that exclusively affects people in larger bodies. And so that level of weight stigma makes it even harder to escape from diet culture, to escape from this idea that you need to lose weight. And I see so many people who have really internalized those beliefs that have been thrusted at them their entire lives, saying like, my body is bad, my body is wrong. What do you mean I don't need to lose weight? Of course I do. I'm XXX pounds. Like, that's, you know, not healthy. And so I think it's really valuable to unpack, you know, for everyone, where you've learned those beliefs. Where did those beliefs come from? How did you internalize those beliefs? And how could you maybe think about health or conceive of your relationship with food or your body outside of that belief system, outside of that idea that higher weight is quote unquote bad or unhealthy or wrong?
I think you've touched upon two important ideas. And one is that often, which is an attribute of diet culture, we confuse health with our desire to not be fat, right? Our desire for beauty. And they are very different things. They are two very different things. And you also talked about fat phobia in society. And we, maybe two episodes ago, Ingrid, we had a researcher from the University of Michigan, Kendrin Sonneville, and a body liberation advocate on the show talking about precisely weight stigma. So how, like, if we go back to the history of dieting and diet culture, I think that's very important to know. And I know it's the first chapter of your book. Can you give us like a very brief sort of like overview of like, how did diet culture come about? Because that way we understand better where we're coming from. And also I think helps not create sort of like a confrontation with those who still believe the things that we don't believe. If that makes
sense.
Right,
absolutely. Yeah, so diet culture has a really complex history, and I think understanding those roots is really helpful toward untangling them and, you know, not just reflexively believing what diet culture tells us. So it has, you know, really sort of complicated roots, and I, you know, have this whole chapter in my book that's actually, I think, the longest chapter in the book, and I had to cut it down from double the length that it was because it's so fascinating. Yeah. There's so much history there. But really some of the highlights are that, you know, the first seeds of diet culture, I would say, were planted in ancient Greece and Rome when the idea of, well, I should back up and say before that even, like ancient civilizations and really cultures around the world still that are not westernized, although increasingly westernization is touching everything. But, you know, civilizations pre-westernization certainly and some remote civilizations now really see fat on the body as a good thing, as a positive thing, right? It means social status, a better chance of survival, a greater likelihood of fertility, greater wealth. And thinness in those moments in history or those civilizations was equated to poverty, illness, death, infertility, you know, the things that were really negative and that people didn't want. The first seeds of diet culture that I found in my historical research were really planted in ancient Greece and Rome, when, you know, it was a time of abundance, it was a time of wealth and richness, and so there was anxiety about what sort of quote-unquote excess meant. And moderation and balance came to be seen as a virtue. Any quote-unquote excess was seen as a flaw to be corrected. And food was, you know, seen as something that should be exclusively consumed for fuel, not for pleasure. Pleasure was really demonized in ancient Greece and Rome. And fatness started to be seen as a symbol of moral corruption. Mm-hmm. So ancient Greek doctors actually came up with the word diet or dieta, which is the ancient Greek term for it. And this, you know, dieta often gets translated as quote unquote way of life, but actually it's better translated. I found some interesting, you know, ancient Greek scholars arguing that it's better translated as regimen, a system of rules about eating and drinking, and to some extent, you know, sexual practices and bathing too. But dieta is the root of the English word diet, and this concept of a diet really took hold for the first time in ancient Greece and Rome. Another kind of key moment in diet culture was in the 1500s. There were, you know, this is early modern colonialism. Settlers in the Americas started to come in and displace the indigenous people. And these settlers believed that they needed to keep eating their quote-unquote correct food, their European foods, not indigenous foods, in order to maintain their bodily superiority, in order to maintain, like, their appearance and also their, basically their right to lord it over everyone else, the people that had just conquered, right? Mm-hmm. And so those were some early roots of it, but really like the sort of, I would say, the fertilization and the sort of germination of diet culture really took hold in the 1800s when these ideas about, who is the correct or morally right type of person started to commingle with ideas about morally correct types of foods. Mm-hmm. In the 1830s, starting in the 1830s and mid-1800s, the idea of evolutionary biology started to come onto the scene. And we had people like Darwin and other white male Northern European scientists who decided that fatness was a marker of evolutionary inferiority, quote unquote, and savagery, quote unquote, because that was more, supposedly fatness was more frequently seen in the people of color that they observed. And already at that point in history, there was this imagined moral hierarchy with people of color at the bottom because basically they needed to have that supposed hierarchy as justification for slavery, as justification for the continued enslavement of people who didn't look like them. Okay. So that was already sort of, that belief system of certain cultures being inferior already existed. But when you brought in the evolutionary theory part of it, it sort of added this layer of like fatness is a marker of this inferiority, quote unquote. This hierarchy of ethnic groups took on a sort of appearance-based quality as well.
Yeah.
And also around that time, there was this guru named Sylvester Graham, who's the namesake of the cracker, the Graham cracker, who started, preaching that, people needed to eat in this austere, bland way, not that quote unquote stimulating foods were the root of all ills, basically. Mm-hmm. So you had this sort of germination of the idea of good and bad foods really taking root there. And he also preached that like his health had really suffered because he's eating the quote unquote wrong foods. And then he cut them out of his life. And now he's this picture of health very much in the same way that we see like wellness bloggers today talking about all the foods that they cut out and how it changed their life and, magically repaired their health for the best. So those are just some of the early roots of diet culture, but, really it is formed in this basis of racism, of xenophobia, and, sort of moralization of food.
Yeah.
And I should also add misogyny, because the early evolutionary biologists who were doing the supposed cataloging of body types also believed that women were a step down from men in every culture they observed, and that fatness was quote-unquote feminine, and so having fat on the body made you closer to a woman and therefore bad. Mm. So there was that piece of it, too. So many systems of oppression sort of intersecting in this early development of diet culture.
Yeah, I like how you, with what you just explained, you sort of like show us that all of this is learned, right? That this has its own history, that this is learned, that we are not born, and I think I've said it before in the other show, we are not born thinking that skinny is good, fat is bad. It's all learned, right? Women don't diet because they want to. And I read this on Virgie Tovar's book, which is such a great book. Christy, you talk about diet culture being a life thief. So why don't you tell our listeners why that is the case?
Yeah, so the term of the life thief is really something I came up with to sort of encapsulate all the ways in which diet culture robs us of our life, our time, our money, our energy, our well-being, our happiness. And it does this in so many subtle and not so subtle ways, right? In terms of time, we spend countless hours and really decades of our lives, some of us, chasing after the thin ideal, chasing after an idea of perfection and nutrition and food that is just unattainable and not real and based on a lie. But, we're told that that's what we need to run after and chase after. And we learn it, as you said, it's really learned beliefs that we take in and then act out of. And so, we can waste so much time pursuing diets that are ultimately not going to work or, they're going to quote unquote work in the short term because temporary weight loss will happen. But then for up to 98% of people, they end up regaining all the weight they lost within 5 years. And there's really solid research showing that. So, it's not a long-term sustainable solution. And in fact, weight cycling, which is, the repeated cycles of weight loss and regain that people undergo when they diet, has actually been shown to be a greater risk factor to your health than staying the same size, even if that's a larger size.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, weight stigma, which is the discrimination against people in larger bodies, that really profoundly affects people's well-being. And that's the way, you know, the main way in which diet culture robs people of their health. It's, you know, weight stigma has actually been shown to be a greater risk factor to health than what people eat. So that is huge when you consider all of these public health messages that we get today telling people what they're supposed to eat, but that are delivered with a side order of weight stigma. And really when that happens, when you deliver nutrition messages with a side of weight stigma, it cancels out any benefit that people might be getting from those nutrition messages because weight stigma is such a greater risk factor to health. Diet culture also, you know, makes people feel like they have to spend this massive amount of energy trying to shrink their bodies in order to be worthy, in order to not be failures. And it paints them as quote unquote failures if they don't succeed in achieving what diet culture tells them they're supposed to, a permanently thin body, a quote unquote perfect diet. And so, you know, in that sense, it really robs people of their happiness and their joy. Robs them of their ability to be present in big and small moments in their lives because they're obsessing about food. They're thinking about food in the background constantly. And also because feeling like a failure makes you feel like crap. Like feeling like a failure is the opposite of joy and presence and well-being. And so, you know, diet culture really robs us of that sense of well-being. It also robs us of our autonomy because when diet culture tells us that we're not allowed to be trusted with food, that we have to give up our agency with food to some outside authority to tell us what to eat in order to eat, quote unquote, correctly, that robs us of a really essential component of happiness, which is agency, which mm-hmm. is, you know, a sense of
choice,
a sense of, yeah, you know, in control over our lives, or a sense of, I don't like the word control really because I feel like it can be wielded so harshly, but a sense of being in charge is what I mean,
yeah.
You know? And so in all those ways and so many more, diet culture really steals these essential pillars of our lives and steals, you know, if we're not careful, it can steal our entire lives. And so that's part of, you know, my reason for writing this book is that I've seen so many people have their lives stolen by diet culture, and I want to help stop that. Mm. I want to help people stop having to go through these big recovery journeys that so many of us have had to undertake and that I myself had to undertake. I want to have people be inoculated from diet culture going forward so that they're not constantly slipping back into it, and so that the next generation hopefully can grow up without it and can actually stay in touch with their intuitive cues about food and their internal wisdom about food without having to get so sidetracked and waylaid by diet culture.
I think that this is like the perfect segue. I think you did such a good job at explaining what diet culture is, how it robs us of our lives, how it affects us in every aspect of our lives. I see it with a lot of the women that I work with. They're stressed out because of their work responsibilities, but so much of their headspace is also in the, what do I eat? What don't I eat? Like, they're spending so much time worrying about that it, in a way, it robs them of really enjoying their career and their lives. And so I feel like it's a good time to move into the practical part of our conversation, where we talk a little bit about how people can start looking at how they eat differently, and maybe start off with the question of, we're at the holiday, it's the holiday season, it's a charged time for many people, there's a lot of food, there's a lot of talk about, maybe you haven't seen relatives in a really long time, and they might be commenting on the way you look. What are some tips that you can give our listeners with regard to how to handle those kinds of situations?
Such a good question, and I think it is so tricky this time of year, and so I just want to send so much compassion to people who are going through this. I think one, you know, overarching tip I have is to have self-compassion in these moments, because we've actually seen in the research that self-compassion is really a key to healing your relationship with food and your body. It's really essential for that process. And something that I see a lot with clients is that they, you know, are beating themselves up for their weight or not eating quote unquote perfectly. And then they find out about diet culture and they find out about all the ways it's been stealing their life, and they jump into beating themselves up for getting caught up in diet culture, which is not helpful. You know, like jumping to beating yourself up over something else isn't going to help you feel better, right? Beating yourself up really doesn't feel good. And so I think the first first step is self-compassion. It's having compassion for the fact that you've fallen into this, understanding that this is part of our common humanity, especially as people assigned female at birth, but increasingly people of all genders. You know, having this pressure on us from day one really is harmful. And of course, we're going to be indoctrinated into it. Of course, we're going to believe these negative thoughts about ourselves. The second thing is, you know, acting out of self-compassion. I think we can set boundaries with the people in our lives. I think it's especially difficult with family, especially when we, you know, if there's people we haven't seen in a while and they're commenting about how our looks have changed or things like that. I think depending on how close you are with your family, you can, you know, have different levels of conversations about this. If you're really close and people understand, you know, even if they don't sort of get what you're going through, but they care about your mental health and well-being, and you can have those kinds of conversations. You can say, look, you know, I'm trying to heal my relationship with food and my body. I've really struggled in the past with this, and it's just not helpful to hear comments about my weight, or it's just not helpful to hear about your diet. Even if you, you know, are talking about yourself, it's really triggering for me and problematic for me to hear about the latest fad diet that you've gone on when diets have been so harmful to me in the past. Or if you're less close with your family, as some of us are, you know, depending on the person too, it can be a different conversation. You can say something like, you know, I'd love to change the subject. I don't feel comfortable talking about this. Or you can just change the subject, just be the like awkward bull in the china shop, be like, look over there, like, oh, hey, you know, tell me about this thing, or change the subject to something that you know they'll be interested in talking about so that it's, you get them away from the topic of diets. Or you can leave the room, you know, you can excuse yourself and go get a drink, call a friend, you know, write in your journal, go on Instagram and get some anti-diet, you know, reinforcement from the memes you see there. But, you know, basically being mindful of what's going to be unhelpful to you in this process of trying to disentangle yourself from diet culture, and then setting boundaries around that so that you can step away from those unhelpful conversations and try to put yourself in a place of greater support.
Christy, and beyond the holidays, how do we free or protect ourselves from diet culture? I always sort of like my call to action to my clients. It's that gaining awareness of it, sort of like turning on our diet culture antenna. It's the first step, right? Noticing it and also how it is affecting our well-being in general, emotional, physical, health, etc. But what are three steps, let's say, that you would tell our listeners are the first steps if you want to start freeing yourself from diet culture?
Yeah, so I think, you know, noticing it is really the fundamental step. And I think with that comes, as we were talking about before, noticing all the sneaky and subtle ways it shows up for you. So really trying to document that and notice as those things come up, like, huh, that's interesting. What am I telling myself right now about weight? What am I telling myself about food that's led me to serve myself this small portion or whatever? And starting to get really curious and get really self-aware about all those ways that it's showing up. The next thing I think is really important is learning to make peace with food. And, you know, that's going to require challenging a lot of those beliefs about your weight and about what that means. So it's all, the steps are never really linear with a step. Yeah. It all kind of blends together, right? But I think, you know, making peace with food means taking foods off your quote-unquote off-limits list, stopping thinking about food as good or bad, but starting to open up to all foods and giving yourself unconditional permission to eat whatever you want, whenever you want it, however much you want, and noticing what comes up for you when you think about doing that. Usually what comes up is a lot of resistance or fear or anger, mix of all of the above. Sometimes there's a sense of relief as well. Sometimes there's a sense of profound sadness for your past self that has had to live with such strictures. But, you know, I think noticing those feelings and just being aware that those feelings are there, especially the feelings of resistance and anger and to some extent sadness too, are there because of diet culture, are there because of the belief system that you inherited from diet culture. And really, if you were left to your own devices, you know, if you were, and as babies and children are, that we see are really intuitive eaters, are naturally intuitive eaters, they don't have rules about what they can and can't eat. They eat for pleasure. They eat for satisfaction. They also have innate cues that guide them towards things that are nourishing and satisfying to them and can give them what they need. So, you know, if we can get back to that place where we are thinking about food as neutral, as not good or bad, and that all foods are allowed, then we can start to make choices from a place of self-care, not self-control, right? So we can start to make choices from pleasure and satisfaction and what's going to feed our hungers and nourish our souls. And then eventually, you know, once we've really broken down the diet culture beliefs and challenged them and pushed back against them, we can also start to think about what might be nourishing and feel good in our bodies. I always say, though, that that is the very last principle of intuitive eating, because you can't really be gentle about nutrition if you still have diet culture beliefs guiding your choices. If you still have beliefs about food being good or bad, if you still have beliefs about your body being the wrong size, it's impossible to approach nutrition in a truly self-caring and truly gentle way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, nutrition is not totally off the table, but it's something that's for way farther down the line.
Okay. Christy,
the other kind of third. Sorry. Oh yeah.
No, I wanted to ask you something. What do you tell, which is really related to your second suggestion? What do you tell someone that tells you, Christy, I'm trying to, yes, follow my hunger and fullness cues, right? My body's cues. But there are so many other factors, external factors, that are not under my control. Like food marketing, if I go to the supermarket, I'm surrounded by food, in the office, right? Like there are so many other factors, let's say, that can disrupt like my hunger and fullness cues. What do you say to someone like that?
Yeah, that's such a common question. I think that's really part of diet culture's belief system in the 21st century, is this idea that the food environment is tripping us up. The food environment is making us eat quote-unquote too much, or the quote-unquote wrong kinds of foods. And it's really interesting when we look at the research on that, that people who are dieters are the ones who are susceptible to that. They're susceptible to food marketing. They're susceptible to larger portion sizes. And to sweet, you know, they sort of gravitate towards sweet foods, versus people who are not dieters are not fazed by that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they may be, they may take pleasure in food and sweet foods in particular. They may, you know, be interested in food and love food, but they just are not swayed in the same way by food marketing, by the presence of particular foods, by what's in the grocery store. Because when people are fully nourished and satisfied, when they are honoring their hunger, that was going to be my third recommendation, by the way, of sort of first steps, is like honoring your hunger, allowing yourself to eat when you're hungry and truly nourishing yourself. When people are fully nourished and not deprived like they are in diet culture, food just isn't that salient of a cue. Food is not that big of a deal. You know, we think about food, and I know this from my personal life as well as my clients that I've worked with on this stuff, is, you know, you go from, I used to think about food, not necessarily 24/7, but like all the time, right? Like, you know, at least once every probably 10 minutes or so. And now, you know, I would say I go hours without thinking about food until I'm hungry, and then I eat, and, you know, ultimately think about food probably six times a day or so when I eat something, and maybe again when I'm thinking about grocery shopping or planning, you know, food to have around for the week. But it's just not that big of a deal. It's not something that I spend much time thinking about, and the foods that I used to think were so quote-unquote hyper-palatable that I lost control around them because of something in the food, because the food was like perfectly engineered to reach this quote-unquote bliss point in my brain, and that these were bad foods that I had to keep out of the house, like chips or cookies or candy or what have you. I have all the time. They're in my pantry now. Like, you know, I haven't gone through the entire bag in one sitting or the entire box in one sitting. I don't lose control over those foods like I used to, and I don't feel quote-unquote addicted to those foods like I used to. And we actually see this in the research, that this idea of quote-unquote food addiction really is problematic and complicated, and food is not actually an addictive substance the way that it's made out to be. So people who are deprived of food tend to eat in a way that can feel addictive, can feel out of control, and they actually gravitate preferentially towards foods high in carbohydrates, high in fat, because those are foods that are going to meet their needs, right? And especially carbohydrates, those are quick energy sources that help meet your needs when you're deprived. So that's why people's quote unquote binge foods or quote unquote trigger foods tend to be high carb foods, not say broccoli. But when people are not deprived, when they've healed that relationship with food and their bodies, they tend to have much more of a balance of food around. They're not gravitating endlessly towards high carb foods. They definitely, you know, have those foods in their lives, but they're not eating in a way that looks or feels quote unquote addictive anymore. And so, you know, the research on so-called food addiction, I think, really comes out of this diet culture place of believing that there's something wrong with food and that the food system is bad and that's making people gain weight and it's making people eat in a quote-unquote bad way, when in fact diet culture itself and the belief systems it inculcates and the weight loss pursuits that it launches for people, those are the real problems in my mind. That's the real public health crisis in my mind. We don't have a quote-unquote obesity epidemic. We have a diet culture epidemic. And that's what we really need to address in order to help people feel balanced and sanguine and good and okay around all foods, even whatever is at the, you know, center of the grocery store.
Cool. That's so, I mean, I feel like we just started having this conversation. We have so many questions.
We actually want to tell you, Christy, that we skipped our break.
Yeah.
Because there was so much content that we said, like, no break. Let's keep going.
We need to have you back because there's so much more we can talk about. So before you go on your book tour, definitely we'd love to schedule to have you back because I feel like this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. We need to talk about the diet culture in men and women, the differences, so much to talk about.
How we promote intuitive eating with kids and toddlers. Anyway, but unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up. We just got the clue from Alexia. So to end this in a high note, we always like to ask our guests, what does living a big life look like for you?
I love that. I mean, to me, having gone through what I did with eating, I think having a big life means having freedom with food, but also having the brain space and the mental energy to devote to other things, to devote to all the things I could possibly want to devote my time to. So for me, that looks like, you know, social justice causes I believe in, being able to, you know, make calls to my Congress people, to go march and canvass for candidates I care about, and, you know, having that giving back part of my life be really fulfilled and satisfied. It also means devoting time to my relationships, you know, and not having diet culture and food fear getting in the way of eating with people, connecting over food, you know, being able to be present with my husband instead of being like, do I look fat in this, right? being able to go to the beach, which is one of my favorite activities ever, and not be constantly judging myself for how I look in my bathing suit, you know, be able to go in the water, like, feel free and float and swim without any sort of care about how my body looks, and being able to devote my time and energy to this career that I care about of educating people on the harms of diet culture and also helping empower people. You know, fundamentally, my goal, I think, is helping people recover from diet culture so that they can go on to have big lives, awesome. So that they can go on to have lives devoted to the things that they truly care about, live their values and be present in their relationships and, you know, be present in their social justice activism and everything else that we all deserve to have in our lives that diet culture so robs us of.
Awesome. And lastly, what is one thing you're excited about?
I mean, these days, it's pretty single-minded. It's my book.
Yep.
I just got I wish I had it next to me. I had it in the other room, but I have the physical copies now of my book, like final hardcover edition, and that is so exciting. Mm-hmm. It's just something that I've worked for probably 35 years, because when I was like 3 years old, I said I wanted to be an author, and I dictated my first books to my parents and have just always wanted to write a book.
That's
and
awesome.
So this is like the culmination of so much.
Congratulations.
It looks great. You already pre-ordered it.
And then if people want to work with you, if they want to find you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think the best way is just my website, which is ChristyHarrison.com. There you can find out information about the book, about my coaching programs, about my, I'm doing more group coaching now as opposed to one-on-one since the book is taking up, you know, book publicity and stuff is taking up a lot of my time now. But I have an online course called Intuitive Eating Fundamentals have my podcast. So it's all there at ChrissyHarrison.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Chrissy, for your time. This was super informative, and I know we will love to have you back because this is just such an enriching and important conversation.
Chrissy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been an honor, and we cannot wait to read your book. And definitely part two of this show will come soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Merry Christmas.